Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, that's me.
And that's all of it.
That's all of us. Yeah. We're here.
Ryan Ashwood is on assignment.
Who is that?
Like eating brisket or something.
He's on assignment with lunch.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, I wanna jump in here with kind of an interesting there was an article that came out in Medium which talked about the development of fusion research, which is something we bring up periodically. And, you know, for those of you that, you know, didn't pay attention, fusion is basically where you take two atoms, merge them together, and they produce a tremendous amount of energy and create some new material, right? And you can use fusion with, let's say, hydrogen. There's also forms using beryllium, etc. And what's nice about it is generally the byproducts are cleaner than fission, where you split something apart.
Right. Less
and
waste.
You might have, yeah. What's that?
Less waste if you can get it to be practical.
Yeah, there are a lot of different, you know, ideas and approaches towards it. Some of them, you know, what happens is that when you do it, you get what's called high amounts of neutronicity. It gives off a lot of neutrons when you first do it because the neutrons are being shedded as you, you know, squeeze these atoms together, and you do need some radiation shielding. But once you shut the thing off, it's fine. Everything is totally cool. But you can actually use it to produce fissile materials too. And it's one of these things that has been in perpetual development since like the 1930s, you know. I think, you know, like one of the original, one of the original developers of television had been working on it. You know, he working on a fusor and different ways of trying to create this. And in the 50s and 60s, it started to explode with, not literally, with more research, the tokamak reactor design, which is this ring where you would use electromagnets to basically heat up a plasma and keep it suspended in the middle, has been a primary area of development.
Now, my understanding on fusion is that we generally understand the means to do it, but we aren't able to make it energy positive. Is that right?
Correct.
We can do the reaction, but we can't pull additional energy out of it.
Yeah, we can get these things to turn on for, you know, milliseconds, but trying to get them to be stable and continuous, they produce enough energy to keep going. We haven't reached that point yet. Now, what's happened in the last 10 years, which has been interesting, is that there was one primary area of research, which was building these tokamak reactors. You know, the Russians were doing it, we were doing it, in Europe they were doing it. You've now had startups which are pursuing their own ideas, and some of them, one of them is working on a much smaller, you know, size tokamak reactor. And you have companies ranging from Lockheed to these startups working on it. And some people think like, hey, this might be something, you know, the joke is fusion's the energy of the future and will always be that way because that we'll never reach there. But there is the article kind of got into some positivity about this, is saying like, hey, no, we think we've nailed down the engineering problems of it, and it's a matter of refining and tackling that. And, you know, we may see something instead of in the next 20, we may see something in the next 10 or sooner.
Wow. I mean, that would be a huge boon to have like a commercially available source of fusion energy. And because once it works, then the gates are open, right? Then
theoretically, yeah.
You could be replacing fossil fuel and nuclear fission energy in the next couple of decades.
That's the hope. And that, well, you know, some of the companies, and we've talked about this before on this show, so a little bit redundant here, but this came up again because this, you know, reading an article that brought up some of the new innovations that are being done there. There's, you know, one of the research institutions working on this, they're using a new flatter superconducting material that is providing greater efficiencies. There's a lot of these little gains here and there. And sometimes that's the way technological revolutions happen. And it's like, yeah, we know it's just it's a really hard problem. And then one day it happens because you get enough little incremental improvements here and there that you get a big leap. And some companies are working with the idea that the fusion reactors are trying to create would be able to be placed into existing facilities right now where we use natural gas or coal or whatever produce energy. And so you can pull those power plants out there, put the fusion ones in there, have them heat up the water and the turbines and whatnot and generate electricity. So,
that would be huge if the technology was such that you could convert existing structures and ideally plug into existing power infrastructure.
So what happens, let's say, that we get in the next 5 years, we do get this. Hey, we think we found a system. It's a little pricey, but we found out it's cheaper than any other form of energy that we have right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to get a massive investment to redo the electrical grid. That's going to happen. You're going to see countries invest heavily and, you know, co-finance to make this thing happen. And we could be looking at, you know, fusing our electrical grids over the next decade. And part of the hope of this is because it's a much cleaner form of energy and arguably one of the cleanest forms of energy you have with the most minimal forms of environmental impact. You know, you would be reducing CO2, you'd be reducing the emissions and the particulates and other things in there.
Not to mention stemming mining and fracking, like just the environmental elements of getting fossil fuels as well as uranium.
Mm-hmm. So my guess is we've gotten rid of things we worried about before. You know, we don't worry about the ozone layer right now. We don't worry particularly in the United States so much about as much about air pollution as we used to, right? We've got our air pollution way, way down, even more so than many European countries, which is something that's, you know, we have different standards than they do, and actually we have cleaner air in our cities than a lot of places in the world. But we've seen this. Acid rain isn't the concern that it was before. Hmm. How much does it change? How much does it not change?
If part of your question is, will we find a way to fret about it? I think history would say yes. You know, there is always going to be a reason for us to believe that the new technology to bring us energy will, whatever our best intentions are, we will find a reason why it is not helpful to us, at least that. And I think that's kind of it's in part to our benefit that we will always, you know, critique and find a flaw in a solution. And in part, it does create, I think, a feedback loop of, you know, a fear of innovation. But I think something like this that would be so cheap and comparatively be really clean, I think would initially spark excitement. But I don't think that it would end us worrying about whether or not this technology is man's original sin that will bring us all to our death.
Right.
I mean, it would have to be a huge boost to, say, the EV market, electric vehicles, of, hey, we have cheap, almost unlimited energy now. Let's start shifting away from fossil fuels. And you could probably see a pretty active push to try to, refresh kind of the existing active, whatever you want to call it, population in the world.
Mm-hmm. Something to think about. I mean, we're all obviously very for it. And just because, like, well, we're going to worry about something else is never an excuse not to move forward. So, you know, it's an area we'll keep checking in on, and hopefully, you know, we'll be able to say, hey, guess what?
But before we move on, I wanted to have kind of a little bit of a more esoteric conversation about that idea, the framing device of, like, oh, it could be 20 years out, but because of this, you know, but because of progress, it could be 10 years out. Because I've always found that framing device, and maybe just because we don't have a better one, to be a little bit misleading in that it assumes that all progress is on some level incremental. And that's why we can break it down into a time frame of, like, okay, well, this is next year, this is 5 years, this is 10 years, this is 20 years, this is 50 years, this is 100 years. When everything that we've seen is really just, it's about problems. It's about engineering problems or problems of things not being efficient enough that once they're solved, we go from, you know, this is 50 years away to this is happening within the next 5 years. I mean, look at like the, how we've talked about reusable rockets on this very podcast from the beginning, with the idea being, oh, it could be, you know, 50 years away to absolutely impossible to do because of the engineering problems, to now it's, you know, as regular, you know, air travel was once was, you know, something that was a rare thing. So I guess, is there a better way for us to use that nomenclature instead of putting it into years, or is that just the way that we can all understand it?
You know, it's a very good point, because there are some technologies which are incremental, like artificial intelligence, you know, and you might say, hey, a thing like an AGI, like an artificial general intelligence, one where you flip the switch and you can talk to it and, hey, how are you doing? I'm doing great. And it completely fools us on every level and creates and does that. That's a really hard problem. That's almost, we took artificial intelligence and drew a circle around a bunch of different skill sets and said, there's that. But in artificial intelligence itself, we see these leaps that we make every couple of years, sometimes every few months, and they're accelerating, and you get the shorter term benefits. You know, I think all of us are sitting near a personal assistant that is good enough at voice interaction to do a lot of things. You know, my car, I flip the switch, is good enough to keep me on that lane and to avoid other cars and to change lanes and stuff. It's not good enough yet to drive itself from here to New York City, but those incremental steps are wonderful and very beneficiary. Fusion is one of those things where it's more of a challenge, because it's like, hey, it's either have it and it's commercially viable or you don't, you know. Fission, more of a gray area, because fission can be sort of incremental to an extent, where, you know, fission kind of comes down to what's your cost of extraction, what's your power plant cost, what are these other ancillary things.
Yeah,
so it is sort of hot.
The physical element of it, fusion, almost maybe necessitates the idea of needing to talk about it in years, because even if there's a breakthrough today, it still has to be built out. Mm-hmm. Where like, if there's an update to Siri, then they can push it without anybody knowing. I mean,
but once we saw we are yet to the point where a reusable rocket is in our lives, right? Like we have yet to take the rocket trip from New York City to Tokyo, and yet when we see it demonstrated, we now understand, okay, this goes out of that theoretical timeline of this is a tech that is 20 years away, now there are much more mundane things like you're suggesting with fusion, where you're like, okay, cool. Well, this thing exists. Now we have to talk about, you know, the governmental, local and federal on exactly how we're going to build these things out, or the private companies that are going to use it for some other level before that.
Well, yeah, you know, and it's interesting though, but on the reusable rockets is, and I think it was, I want to say it was like 2011 when Elon Musk did his National Press Club talk and said, hey, this is the goal for SpaceX. We're going to try to do this. We want to make our rockets reusable. We think the physics works out. You know, reality may have some other idea. And it was 5 years later that we started to see, you know, the landings of the grasshoppers and all this. And now we're in a world where they are real. And they're having an impact. Like SpaceX just let go of 10% of its workforce over the weekend. And the reason it was is that they're shifting their focus now to building their next generation fully reusable rocket, Starlink. And because they finished primary development on the Falcon 9 reusable, they have a lot of, they don't need as many boosters now. They don't need to make as many boosters. And so they're kind of like, well, we had a lot of our manufacturing was geared towards making this, and coinciding with the softening of the launch market for the next 2 years, they're like, well, we're going to let go of people. And was part of, some would say, the success of reusability had a real effect right now, which is sort of, you know, kind of an interesting sort of thing, looking at the consequence of that, you know. Mm-hmm. But we get like, yeah, I mean, I think reusability is a lot like kind of fusion in the sense that, like, if it works, you know, and there's a time between when we think we know that it can work to when we see the economic thing. But once we watch, you know, the grasshopper test rockets come back down, we're like, this is a solvable problem. You know, this is just a matter of keep launching, keep crashing until you don't crash anymore. We haven't had that moment yet with Fusion, but we might be.
I guess that's my question, is that is there like some sort of DEFCON problem setting where it's like, all right, so the lowest form of it is we've proven the tech, or we are fairly certain that, like AI, this is a matter of computing power and server space and the interconnectivity of incrementally evolving products, and we get a sense where we can draw a fairly accurate roadmap of, okay, things are progressing at this level, chips are getting, you know, faster, the server space is more abundant and freer at this level, so now we can use these things. So at this point, 5 years down the road, we believe that things that we are hitting our heads on the ceiling are now will be possible, versus this is going to require something that we have not yet seen be done.
I think it's like Fusion, it's like the first. It's saying, hey, it's an engineering problem. We know the physics. We've spent tons of money on this because we understand the physics of it, but it comes down to, we think everything we understand about it is a matter of improving tolerances and improving, you know, overall the kind of machinery you're using. AI, some would argue, Kurzweil and others would argue that AI is in that category too. It just really is an engineering problem. Other people might say, like, no, there are still some profound things we need to understand about, you know, how we humans process information. And until we can understand that, you know, we're not going to be able to know how to make a system that does the things that we do or thinks like we do or improves upon that in a dramatic way. So I would say there's more debate, maybe even in AI, as far as getting to the AGI than there is Fusion, you know. But because AI is something that's more complex in some ways, a lot of ways, we sometimes feel like, well, that breakthrough could be next week, you know, because it is going to be some special self-learning algorithm, or is something that all of a sudden can happen, and then we have it. Or it could be something that eludes us for 100 years.
There could also be a tough thing where, you know, in the example of SpaceX with the, you know, planetary travel from New York to London or whatever, that the upgrade to the, you know, the global power system with fusion technology, I don't know what those immediate like benefits look like, right? Like it would obviously be more cost effective, reduce waste and environment and fuel and stuff, but there's not like a thing you can hold on to with fusion power just yet.
I for me, it kind of still comes back to space travel. When you get to the point where energy production starts getting so ridiculously inexpensive and you have so much extra energy you can use, things we've talked about before when he had, you know, Jonathan Medajian on to talk about, you know, the lab he was working on beam propulsion and, you know, doing things like that. You know, there was a, I think it was MIT or some group, they built so far the most successful electrostatic airplane. You know, it's an airplane that uses these wings. It was a model airplane that uses an electrical charges particles, and they move from one surface to the next, creating airflow. And they flew this thing inside of a gymnasium, and it was a kind of a really cool thing, this super silent, eerie flight, watching this airplane fly. And because there's no moving parts, it's just using, and this is, you know, people have been building lifters as hobbyists for years, but the problem, the one caveat on this was, is it had to have an electrical wire connected to it because it used, you know, a large amount of electricity to power it. Mm. When you have energy to spare and you have fusion and stuff, you can start using beamed energy to power things like airplanes and stuff and not even have battery packs, and you don't even think about these things. And that becomes a very, you know, and it was funny because, you know, I read a, you know, forum where people were dismissive of this, like, well, because you have to have your power attached to it, it doesn't make much sense. Who cares? It's useless. And it's like, no, there's this whole world of cool things waiting for us, yeah, you know, when we can beam energy.
I guess that's true. Like, if once you get a system of fusion technology that you're able to multiply power, then it becomes about miniaturizing, which has definitely mm-hmm. been a huge part of technology over the past, I mean, since the history of computing, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you are able to say, well, you know, instead of a watch battery, these little watch batteries, you have a mini fusion bit. Well,
I don't.
And that's very long term, but.
But we may, or we may never, but you might, but you start to get things like there are technologies right now working on the idea of wireless transmission of power. Mm-hmm. And so, and there's companies that like, there's Artemis, which is working on a thing called P-Cell, which is like tiny little cellular networks. But if you look at the patent filings in it, it looks like it'd be used for beam to power, like precision, things like this. So there's nothing about that on, as far as I know, on their actual website about using it for transmitting power. But when you read the patent applications, they talk about potentials for that. And that's a thing where you get into, it's like, well, okay, you know, if we don't, you know, we can, you know, we can use five times as much power to power your iPhone, you know, but you know, it doesn't matter because power is so cheap, then you don't care. And it's not producing fossil fuel, you know, using fossil fuels, then you get into these other technologies too, become much more practical. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll, you know, I, you know, part of me is hoping that, you know, sooner than later we get to talk a breakthrough, but part of me thinks that, you know, in 2024 on Weird Things, we'll be like, hey, I read a really cool article on fusion and it appears that we're getting really close.
Well, I'll tell you what, folks, you can be with us that entire ride until 2024. But if you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, that is where you can not only support this weird little show about science and the supernatural and everything in between, but also you can get early access to our after show. It's called After Things. It's where we take a bit of a break to talk about how we create. For everything, create video, create books, create merchandise, anything involving our modern world and how we stay creative and hopefully even make a buck or two off our work is covered in After Things. You can get it early if you head on over to patreon.com/afterthings.
That's right. No, /weirdthings.
Oh, Jesus. Weird thing. So caught up.
The plight of the podcaster.
So caught up in the after thing.
I've turned into a ghost blur there for a moment.
Oh, yeah. Just a little bit.
Yeah. On the video version, we're getting the stalling again on Andrew's connection. But hopefully it clears up.
Yeah. The audio is fine.
That's another area, too, that's sort of interesting is that, like, I can't buy a better connection where I'm at. Right. Cannot purchase a better one, and we're in 2019, and this is the state of things.
Man, I had a very frustrating conversation with my 13-year-old little brother, who I bought a laptop for Christmas so he could play Fortnite on his laptop because he can't learn to code on an Xbox. So I bought him this laptop, and I'm like, just play more Fortnite on your laptop. Like, just make me that promise. I'm buying you something that can handle it. Go do it. Mm-hmm. So he's having a problem. Number one, I found out something. 13-year-olds don't know about speedtest.net or really the idea of how fast internet is. All he knows is what his ping is on Fortnite.
Right.
That is the universal understanding of how fast his internet is compared to his friends. Is
which is important ping. when the tick rate is high, your ping, you know, your ping's vital. So
it is. No, look, it makes sense. It was just, you know, I was learning a new language while talking to him. But I found out, Andrew, that back where we are from in South Florida, just tremendous spread of AT&T fiber. They had my stupid fart sniffing 13-year-old little brother. Boy, do I love him. But I'm like, I can't believe that you have access to, you know, a gig symmetrical fiber. And I'm sitting here in what is supposed to be the cradle of all technological innovations. And I can't for the life of me get AT&T to roll out fiber in my neighborhood. I have called, you know, this is what I've done to AT&T. I call them. I just leave messages. I figure out the phone tree to get to their engineering department, and I just leave them messages. I'm like, look, I don't know what needs to happen. Like, I don't know. Should I do I have to start canvassing around my neighborhood and get X amount of people to sign up for AT&T for you to roll out fiber? Whatever it is. I'll go knock door to door like a Jehovah's Witness. I will proselytize for this massive corporation as long as it gets me something better than, because Andrew, I'm in the exact same boat that you are, where it's like all I get is I'm paying for whatever the top of the line Comcast is, and it is a joke.
Well, that was Google Fiber's model, was like, hey, go to your neighborhood and get people to sign, you know, this online thing. And
sure, Google Fiber's model was also, let's light a pile of money on fire to see if we can't scare these other companies into doing stuff, which they
worked.
Did,
which
it was successful.
Yeah,
no, they sure did. They lit the ass on fire for Time Warner and AT&T and Comcast in certain markets. Mm-hmm. The problem was they didn't build a business model to, you know, stay in the game all that much, or it was ultimately going to be too expensive for them to try and continue to make it a regular thing, which is fine. That's their job. Like they wanted to do what they wanted to do, and they did it. But man, fie on you, AT&T.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, the boulevard of broken Google dreams, you know, is wait until we get Google Fiber. Nope, never going to happen now. You know, it just... You know, remember back in the day, back when, you know, Google bought, what was the, you know, Google Voice was the phone number system was based on, I forget, like.
Oh, was that Grand Central?
Yeah, they bought Grand Central.
Yeah.
And then there was the.
And that became Google Voice.
Right.
Yeah. And there was the talk of like, hey, you know, Google may come up with a free telephone service. You know, Google may be trying to totally disrupt it. Google bought Android, the makers of the Sidekick Danger. And, you know, Google is thinking about disrupting telephone. Apple's coming out with their high-priced phone and working with AT&T. What if Google buys some smaller, you know, wireless carriers and Google totally disrupts it? And it was, you know, this thought about like, man, like what if they, because, you know, they gave us cool free stuff before, you know, search was super functional, Gmail, online storage. And then, you know, of course that never eventually materialized the way we wanted it, because like Larry Page or whatever was just obsessed with, or Sergey was obsessed with the idea of like, let's get rid of the document format or something. And it was, you know, which was a great opportunity for Dropbox. But there was that period where we thought like, hey, maybe, you know, we could have this radically different version of the future.
Well, and all of this is all of those plans got put on hold, at least as far as fiber. And you've seen this with Verizon got in hot water in New York because they were not rolling out Fios the way that they said that they would. And that's because they knew it would be cheaper to eat whatever penalty on that contract was and wait for 5G technology to blanket people with invisible wireless rather than keep building, you know, fiber lines,
yeah.
Which is a shame. I think the whole 5G thing is a shame to me, because the companies that would use 5G to like bring 5G to the home are a lot of the companies that you would not want to like even deal with, you know, if like there was a whole thing during CES where AT&T came out and said, oh yeah, we have 5G, and people on their phones would see a little 5G icon. And it wasn't 5G as we know it, in the same way that like in a similar way to like when 4G in America rolled out, and it's not the 4G that is in the rest of the world. It was like 5G F or something. It was like a fake 5G that had like part of the interconnect was using some of the faster speed. But it's all like fake marketing stuff. Not to mention, you know, mobile caps, someone brought up in the chat, like all of these companies still do some version of throttling. And that stuff that flies on your phone. But if you're at home, you would like to think you have unfettered access to the internet. And if AT&T is in charge of that pipe because they're the one that has 5G and you can't get Fios or any sort of fiber from someone else, that sucks. That's an industry that needs a Google or some moneyed interest to come in and say, okay, well, we're going to try to be better than everyone else. And,
sure.
And maybe Google is also biding their time to make a 5G play as well. But
yeah, I don't know if Google is going to dip their toe back into those waters. They seem to be consolidating a little bit more into what kind of makes them money in you know, the AdWords play. And I don't quite know, unless, I mean, if we're going way back, as Andrew mentioned, back in the rumors of Google Pass, that they were going to launch, that Android was not just going to be an open source OS, but it was going to be a full opportunity for you to have a free phone service if only you are forced to see X amount of Google AdWords. That being said, though, I do think that it's look, telecommunications is hard. Let me give the devil their due first, and then we can complain about them as they so richly deserve. Laying cable is expensive. Laying cable, specifically when you get into more rural areas, is at times prohibitively expensive. Creating a wireless network is also very expensive and gets more or less and less cost effective the more you move into rural areas. It is a tremendous engineering feat that these things exist. I once got into a conversation at a party out here with a guy who worked for a major telecom, and as I said many of the same things that that Bryce says right now, he, you know, gave me a long diatribe about exactly how hard his job is. And I assure you, when he was done talking, I was convinced that his job was very hard. That being said, it does seem to bear, you know, some weight that without competition, we get things like data caps. We get things like less rollout. We get things like, well, you want to know what? This is where the tech sort of ends, and the consumers are happy, so we're not going to do much more about it. When there is competition, like Google, and again, it took them pretty much deciding to light a gigantic pile of money on fire to do it. Man, they sure move fast. Man, Time Warner and AT&T and Verizon in competing markets seem to offer competitive products at a fairly speedy timeline.
Google moved fast in the cities that made it very easy for them to move fast. That's the problem with fiber versus like 5G or wireless.
Yeah.
Fiber means laying cables. And laying cables
it's construction.
Hard 150 years ago with telegraphs, and then laws put in place so that we didn't have, like, anybody who wanted to have a telegraph company didn't start stringing wire. The same with telephones, and then power is that cities put limits on these things, and, you know, to prevent, I don't know, things like fires and stuff like this. It tests the libertarian limits of myself when you go like, no, I understand why, you know, we have, you know, California wildfires. Probably could have, some of them have been caused by, you know, electrical power, you know, electrical cables. What would have happened if we had, you know, 40 different providers stringing cables through forests and stuff? With fiber, that's not the problem, but it's like, it's digging things up, it's putting things through there. And sometimes the holes are already there and the conduits are there, but the hoops you have to go through and the entrenched people there, cable companies do not play nice. They do not play nice. So, you know, there are stories about, like, you know, people wanting to have town meetings to decide about, are we going to let another cable company come in there? And the cable company is parking all their trucks on the roads to stop people from showing up at the meeting. You know, the lengths at which people go to protect these things. So, you know, the advantage of wireless and stuff is theoretically, hey, yeah, if we go wireless, you know, well, then it's cheaper. That's what's helped us, you know, provide internet access to the rest of the world. You know, where it's too expensive to lay cable and stuff. But you know, I remember getting my hopes up about WiMAX.
I bought a WiMAX phone, and I'm very mad about it still.
I didn't even know they sold them.
That's right, Andrew. Like, 5G offers a very cost-effective solution to covering much more of the country and the world, honestly. In a much cheaper way, they can use existing cell phone towers and upgrade them. For a lot of cases, it becomes cheaper than like dealing with right-of-ways and access to pipes and stuff. But on the same token, you would hope that that means that that cost-effectiveness makes its way to the consumer side, either by better policies, reducing reducing the usage of data caps, or better pricing, and that stuff still doesn't seem to bear out. In recent history.
Yeah, and you know, part of the problem is you know, we don't need to get into a, you know, a a debate about different laws as far as, like, you know, internet and regulation on that to an extent that would not bore everybody else to death. The problem is that whenever legislation gets passed, historically, and this is almost always the case, the entrenched people are the ones that ultimately end up shaping that. And even things that seem benign or seem like it's going to make things fair or more open often have the opposite effect, because the general heart of the bill gets passed, but in the AT&T has been doing this for 100+ years, you know, something gets added or tweaked or changed, and you find out that, yeah, there's this little thing there about an approval of number of permits or committees or something that happens there. And that's the thing that, you know, I know frustrates Justin, Brian, and myself about some of the discussions about, you know, open internet and all that, is it like, yes, these are great ideas, but when you look at what happens by the time these bills get passed, this legislation happens, the entrenched powers usually become even more powerful.
Well, and I'm not suggesting that necessarily.
No, and
although I will say, I do think that there does need to be, instead of us continuing to reinterpret like the Telegraph Act, the FCC, I do think that there's probably room, even in my, you know, generally limited government kind of framework, to say there probably should be at least some legislative definitions of what a modern mass media culture is, just so we even are talking about things that are relevant, instead of continuing to kind of look at text that was obviously not meant for what we're talking about right now.
Agree. I mean, and I'm for, like, yeah, you know, we have to set regulations on these things, but it's just historically, and it's like with net neutrality, every time it rears its head, I'm like, I understand the spirit, but man, the implementation of these things never works out the way we want.
Again, that's my biggest thing, is that it's like, I would rather us have an open discussion about this than have, you know, the FCC, which I think everybody, every side of this issue can agree is frustratingly inconsistent, oftentimes can be have leadership that we do not agree with, continue to kind of play ping pong with this idea instead of saying, well, look, it's not like we don't, I mean, in a world where we're dragging all these tech CEOs out to question how their products affect our world, and we've already had to regulate telecommunications in terms of federal monopolies before, probably is room for us to just, you know, draw out some new laws on exactly what this stuff is and have an open discussion about it, as opposed to, you know, having selective redefinitions of a text that was written very, very long ago.
Yeah. So, speaking of, and we'll move on to something totally not controversial, about time. There was a study that just came out, a comprehensive review by some Italian researchers, and I think it's in Science Journal, I think it is. And what they wanted to do is let's take a look at all of the data out there about GMO, about using genetically modified organisms in food sources, whatever. Let's take a look to see, have we found any effects, any things for cause for concern, et cetera. And the answer is nope. GMO is, you know, probably one of the safest food technologies we've ever had. There has been just no instances of that we can, you know, there's in all the studies, there were some studies that came out and said, oh, we think I found a problem. They found out, you know, gone back, looked at it, did a flawed research, whatever. As far as the amount of research that's gone into this, it's one of the most thoroughly tested things we have out there that affects consumers, infects food, affects our safety. And the results keep coming back. This stuff is safe. Not only is it safer, it's actually improving food quality, making things safer. And this just came out like a few days ago, the study which shows this. Yet, you walk into a supermarket and over the loudspeaker, somebody says, check out our GMO-free cookies. You walk into certain restaurants and they see on the front, like, proudly serving non-GMO blank. Mm-hmm. What is the disconnect? Because I know the people who are some of the most anti-GMO people are people who would consider themselves extremely pro-science, yet we have this barbaric, medieval, attitude about this, you know, and I know, you know, and so what's up?
What I mean, it's probably very similar to the arguments of like fluoride in public drinking water, right? The idea of like someone tampering with what you would consider a rather natural sort of an element to the world, right? Right, a man messing with water, a man messing with food, someone like it, it. I mean, I think it's partly conspiratorial, just someone acting without logic. You know,
what I'm saying is like I can name at least two restaurants, big brand chains that actually have signs out there that proudly state in these parts, either in all their food or part, they don't use GMOs. Fluoride, you kind of go, yeah, you're nutty. And there was just a town in Alaska they actually have some data on that they looked at. They got rid of all the fluoride in the water. Guess what? Kids are having more cavities. Shocker. This is a mainstream view. This is a very anti-GMO stuff is very, very mainstream.
We should also point out for the listenership here that Andrew lives in Los Angeles, I live in the Bay Area, and Bryce lives in Austin, which is very often referred to as the LA or San Francisco of Texas. So, like, we are in places where signs trumpeting anti-GMO stuff would
Chipotle. Probably... Chipotle is everywhere.
Chipotle is everywhere. Chipotle is everywhere, yes. Right? So I'm not trying to belittle the point, because I do think that it is worldwide. But in case there is a reaction from listenership, let's point that out for the sake of pointing it out. I will say there is just...
CVS. I was in CVS when I heard the loudspeaker announcement of the GMO-free cookies.
Is that national, though?
Sure. I understand there are certain things that are... bubble, but I mean, I'm talking about like these are all national chains.
Mm-hmm. I just googled GMO, and the very first thing that came up was something that looks very clearly paid for by something called the Non-GMO Project, and it is a pretty negative stance on GMO foods. Here is a part of it. I'm going to read this quote from this heading: "Why should you care? Genetically modified foods have been linked to toxic and allergic reactions, sick, sterile, and dead livestock, and damage to virtually every organ studied in lab animals. The effects on humans of consuming these new combinations of proteins produced in GMOs are unknown and have not been studied." See more on this list. So,
which is false. Which is
sure.
False.
I'm not saying it's not false.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
But
yeah.
These are the talking points. The idea that like, yeah. Genetically modifying animals, giving them a different type of food, affects their internal systems. And if we say that we don't know what it does to humans, then you get to put two and two together on that.
Feed them at 2 o'clock has a different effect than feeding them at 1 o'clock. We go dig into but that's the frustrating thing is that there are. We know more about GMOs than we do about climate change. And we understand way more about there are so many more benefits now. We're seeing improved crop yields, less use of pesticides, fertilizers, all these things. It's having a very good positive effect on us, you know, but it's one of these things where it is, you know, and there's many, many, many different kind of like things, but like, you know, one of the great uses for GMOs is less pesticides, less other things like this. But there's a lot of bad information. And I think it's a frustrating thing because if you want to look at one technology that can help save lives right now, improve the food quality around the world, we have, you know, we're improving crop yields, but we want to improve the nutrition content. It's this.
Does this plug into our earlier conversation about fusion? we can have something that does have a very obvious positive benefit, and yet we will find a reason to understand that it is indeed our original sin that is killing us.
Perhaps I think that it's a, you know, I get frustrated because I will watch people on one hand, you know, make passionate cases for environmentalism, climate change, things like this, and then. Those anti-science idiots. And then these people who are criticizing them quickly say something stupid about GMOs or ill-informed or whatever. And it's like, I don't think science plays any part in what you care about. You only like it when it reinforces a belief you already have.
I wonder, if there is a money, I mean, I want to know what I feel like.
Follow
there's got to be
the money.
There's got to be a money. There's going to be a moneyed element.
Who's wetting their beaks on all this GMO hoopla?
It would not be crazy to me to think that a section of the agricultural global market would be damaged if people are suddenly okay with GMOs, whether it is slightly more expensive to develop that technology, whether a certain company or conglomerate is behind in getting that technology, and would rather.
I don't think that maybe, but I know it's a mindset. I mean, I know the mindset. I see the mindset out here, and it is this. It's a kind of an anti-technology, anti-industrial sort of attitude. That's where it comes from that I see it. And that's a very, very pervasive group. And you get people who are, you know, get groups who look, you start talking to people, these groups, I don't think they're astroturfed by, you know, corporations. They're given funded by individuals and people who have money who just have this adverse, irrational fear to this sort of thing. That's what I've seen, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you when people, this sense of what purity is supposed to be, whatever, you know.
So you think it's more people trying to exploit a human's tendency to see those
those ideas? No, I think it's, and Andrew can correct me if I'm misstating his argument, but that this is, for some, a natural, logical, in their own brain, place to land. That this is... We have strayed too far from the path of nature's choice for us, of how we are best meant to survive, and that this is the latest example of it. And then you can tie in, you know, like most conspiracies are conspiracies kind of sewn onto other conspiracies, but then you can drive in the, like, well, for the drive of the almighty dollar, look what we've done, even to our own food. We've tried to stretch the land too far. We have tried to squeeze too much out of the natural harvest that we have been given by Mother Gaia, and this is our downfall. Our greed has finally reached into our own plates, and we are poisoning our children. I think that there is, technology is littered with the idea that with every advancement or even stuff like I think you were right to point out fluoride in the water, that it's like, hey, look, this is a way that we could safeguard against unpredictable water supply and just general health amongst its inhabitants. Hmm. And we look at it, some look at it and say, like, why? Water's perfect. And now you're adding this for some nefarious reason. There is, I think, I hesitate to call it natural, but I think that there is just a line of thought that is, hey, we are spurning our parents, our natural path.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow, anybody out there who's, you know, and again, GMO is a technology that could be used for, you know, you could, you know, genetically modify organisms to do bad stuff if you wanted, but, you know, I could cultivate, you know, a strain of apricots with way higher amounts of cyanide in them, you know, like without even having to use GMO, you know, but it's a thing that categorically we've seen, you know, just numerous benefits from this as far as adverse health effects and all that. We've not been able to measure somebody so much as getting a single cough from this. Mm-hmm. Yet the attitude and the vitriol at which it's regarded by some people just seems, it's highly irrational to me. And again, I'm not saying, accept all technology with no checks or whatever. Not my point at all. It's let's look at these things much more rational.
I think that, and that is the frustrating part, is that the conversation becomes about the practice in general and not the regulation of, like, okay, well, what's good, what's bad, how can we, what should we expect from it? What are pitfalls of it? Instead of, it is just kind of a conversation about whether or not it at writ large is good or bad, that tends to get folded into branding. I mean, really, the GMO is just a new way that we can say organic. You know, that's how it's used. Non-GMO is just a new branding term that is basically applied to the same kinds of applications in terms of the businesses that want to make a big deal about it.
I wonder how much of this is also piggybacking off of the general negative publicity around high fructose corn syrup over the past decade or so, right? The idea of like, oh, well, you know, this is a substitute for something that is for say sugar, but it's got these various effects, and whether there are remnants of that idea and that feeling of like, oh yeah, like companies shouldn't be messing with the food, and that is specifically what GMO is in a very abstract sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're going to find, we'll go back 100 years ago and we'll find arguments for advertisements for the more natural version of this, mm-hmm. you know, use this, you know, use Pall Mall's more natural nicotine, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Much more full of flavor. And we're going to find that. Again,
I mean, I don't know. My point is always that nature has, is, and will forever be trying to kill us. Mm-hmm. And it's only through its subjugation that we survive. So we are in active competition to make nature yield to our benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. Monkey Bananas of the Boston Monkey Bananas brings a very interesting point. I wonder what percentage of people who go to CVS and use their pharmacy are also against GMOs. Those are two circles that don't seem like they ever intersect. I'm inclined to say the opposite. I think it's a thing that people hear it and they don't know enough about it. And there is a very, very, very vocal anti-GMO lobby that is trying to influence the rest of us. When you walk into a restaurant, like I say, like Chipotle, which I don't know why I would, and you see, we don't use GMO, we don't use this, we don't do that, you know, you realize that there has been an influence. You know, the push for legislation to try to have to label things that use GMO or not, which gets to be very convoluted and very complicated. You know, the fact that it's a thing that people proudly advertise shows you that the pseudoscience has had way more influence than perhaps it should.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I could go on about, you know, the stupidity of banning plastic straws or bags. So, you know, but I'll spare everybody that.
Do we have time for one more thing? I found some.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Bryce. Yes. Yes. Please.
Let me find the right name of the person who sent this in. But they sent along this news story, as people are welcome to do. There's an email in the show notes that you can see on how to send something. And is it not Jamie? RJ. RJ sent this in. And I believe RJ has sent stuff in before. But I got a video for you guys. And before we even begin, what we've got an image here. What do you think this sort of scene that is happening among us?
Well, this looks like a man who's trimming the Christmas tree. He's putting up some Christmas ornaments. There's a nice little angel up on top of the Christmas tree. Just looks like a nice, wholesome moment in the life of Christmas season.
Okay. We are now being joined with a notable lunch eater, Brian Brushwood. Brian.
Yo, sorry, notable lunch eater? Is that putting that on my tombstone, are we?
You were on assignment eating lunch.
Okay,
you were credited
yes.
At the beginning of the show.
However, I am so dedicated to the cause that I dedicated even extra time on my way back from lunch listening to an as-yet-unreleased comedy album that is fantastic and features a cameo of a relative of one of the members of this very panel right now that I enjoyed immensely.
Oh, the more talented relative.
Yes. You know what? All of us will cop to that. If this album is any evidence, then yes, that's exactly correct.
Let's go ahead and get back to this video.
Unfortunately, I've seen the headline of what we're looking at.
Yeah, you. I did not expect you to be in the room for this, so you are not participating in this guessing game.
Wow, Brian. Here, less than a minute, already ruining it.
new record.
All right, so all right, here we go. I can do this without spoilers. Right.
We like loaded it up this year too.
So can Andrew? Can you? Ooh.
All right, pause. Because you see, it looks like the Christmas tree is shrugging, right?
Yeah, it kind of looks like the Christmas tree is alive. The man is now not trying to trim the Christmas tree as it looked in the still. It looks like the Christmas tree is already decorated. He is now trying to futz with something inside of it, maybe even trying to rip the beating heart out of this living organism Christmas tree itself.
I'm trying to figure, is it what's in the tree? I'm thinking, like, right now I'm thinking cat for obvious reasons.
Yeah, cat would be my initial thought there.
Okay. Oh, wait.
Oh, my God, it's a snake!
Hiding
in the tree!
Hello, gentlemen, and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast.
And it's snapping at this man who now has an ornate broom.
Jack Hogan, age 19, was called out to a home on the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, Australia on New Year's Eve.
Of course it's Australia.
To remove a snake from a family's Christmas tree. This is so crazy. He pulls out, well, we could skip ahead just a little bit.
Oh my God, that snake is gigantic.
It's about a 5 or 6 foot snake.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Merry Christmas.
Man, so, and it's Australia, so it's summer there. It's warm.
Right. Yeah, the snake catcher in the videos says, oh, well, you know, he probably got into your house and did not know what to do, but he saw the tree and that looked familiar to him.
Man.
And he posted up in the family Christmas tree.
Now he's doing the magic rope with the snake. I'm impressed.
Hey, that dude is stunting pretty hard with this snake.
So you can just see it pop out right. Ooh.
I think you guys underestimated the length. That looks like at least a 6 foot snake. Like
I said 5 or 6 feet.
Dude is holding it out end to end. And it's still got curls left in it.
Yep.
Oof.
So, snakes, everybody.
That's another Aussie Ripper summer for me, the snake.
I wanted it to be an adorable cat.
Meow. Australia would have none of your fanciful ideas.
No, the snake ate the cat.
Oh no.
Want to do picks?
Let's do picks.
Let's do picks. I got a pick. I've been working my way through this since it came out on, I think, New Year's Day, and that is the new Netflix series Tidying Up with Marie Kondo.
I mute myself.
What just
okay,
happened?
All right.
did somebody like have a cultural bias explosion or something?
I don't know.
Or?
Look, it's the most priciest picks.
I mean, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. But we're very accepting here. Let's show this.
This is a very sweet show. So Marie Kondo is a Japanese. She's well known for. She wrote a book called Tidying Up on her methods of tidying up messes and homes. And so this short series, it's only like 8 episodes. It's set up like any home improvement reality show. She goes into people's homes and talks them through the process, and then she leaves because she mostly lets them do kind of all the heavy lifting. And then you get to see their homes look a little bit nicer. It's so weird because it is definitely a home improvement show, but it is incredibly low stakes. In a lot of the episodes, the home.
You think?
Well, okay. Look.
We have completely regressed now. We've completely regressed into infantile, you know, man baby world. Is it? We now watch a show about cleaning your room.
Okay.
Okay.
No, first of all, right, I'm on Team Bryce on this because I've watched my daughter, who is in love, like her number one form of entertainment now are the YouTube videos. Have you seen this? Where it's just somebody taking action figures and dolls or whatever and just talking through scripts, and clearly the
playing
hands are
with
visible.
Toys, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she loves it because it's almost like an adult is paying attention to her.
I'm going to make a fortune, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the unboxing videos and play them in reverse.
You're going to create the boxing movement.
Boxing videos, yeah. Well, I definitely know this is very low stakes. You look at some of the homes that she goes to, including the very first one. Someone decided to make that the first episode, and it's like, this house is not even that bad. But it's like any home improvement show, it's interesting to see. You know, you get the, she shows you how she folds clothes. She talks you through how she gets rid of things that, that you don't need or don't like anymore.
I think that's the biggest thing. And I became aware of this lady because a friend of all of ours, Shannon Morris, had her book. And so we all wound up talking about it. But like the idea being that you are not just tidying up as in putting things away, but rather there is a psychological element of letting go of things. And that's kind of, and you even see that in all the branding of like, you know, that, or the meme that kind of went around over the weekend about like, you know, yeah, does it spark joy? Does this spark joy? Does this not spark joy? So anything that you see that you might have non-joyful feelings about, you need to throw away. You need to get out of your life. However,
goodbye, penicillin medication.
Ideally, that would, but it's a neat show, and it's pretty short. It's as a piece of reality style television, it's really weird to see the way that it is shot. If you're someone who kind of looks at that stuff, kind of can kind of dissect that stuff, it's worth checking out an episode or two because there. Marie Kondo only speaks a little bit of English, so she has a on-site translator who is a little bit a part of the process. But it's weird in that there are parts where Marie is speaking in Japanese and it's translated on screen versus she starts to speak in Japanese and then it's dubbed over with the translator speaking in real time or dubbed over. Not to mention it's shot very weird. But it's a cool little thing, and I am enjoying watching it. Andrew,
well, I mean, like she's adorable, right? That's the kind of that's really what makes it a television show is that she is a personality, and to watch her interact with these people is kind of the entertainment value beyond, as Andrew so bluntly put it, watching people clean their room.
Well, and it's earnest. It's completely earnest. You know, she comes in and she does a little prayer in the house to like welcome herself to the house, and like there's a little bit of like, I think some of it ties into Shintoism and energies and the idea that objects have entities within them.
I like the episode where she has to battle the closet demon. That was my favorite.
Like, so I think that we can all relate to that feeling of chaos coming or order coming from chaos and a job well done, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's fine for us to say whatever the vehicle, whether it's a fictional narrative story or a quote unquote reality television thing or whatever, like your mirror neurons fire and you experience that sweet sense of satisfaction of a job well done where it's like, I can breathe now. Everything is made right with the world.
Right.
I'm assuming that's the quote unquote drug that this delivers, right?
Like how it's made, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. Sure, yeah. Like that oddly satisfying, like, oh good. Another link has been made in this chain. I could watch this all day.
Well, and this is maybe a little more educational because it's very applicable information, right? It's like how she folds clothes.
Oh, you didn't see the saltine crackers episode of How It's Made, did you?
Well, it's that's the thing where it rides that line between reality, which is like living pervasively through someone else's experience, and home improvement, which is educational in style and trying to pull actual information out of it. It kind of bridges that gap. So there is part of that, yeah. But you also get the sense that this is a very personal experience because in a lot of cases, some of these homes look fine, and you see the improvements and they look nicer and more tidy for sure, which is probably why they don't lean heavier into like, you know, hoarders, mini
hoarders,
or something, right?
Hoarders was
hoarder horrors is something we can pitch.
No, but I mean, hoarders is pretty much the 21st century version of the sideshow. Like, oh yeah. Jesus, look at these guys. Am I right?
Right. These are more like if your closet's a mess, you know, your closet's a mess. And that's something that you hide by closing the closet door. But when you are going to pull out a shirt and you see it's a mess, that's an everyday chaotic thing.
Right. That does not spark joy.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. So that's the thing that I've kind of been giving a little attention to this week.
All right. my mom during Christmas would not shut up about like some Dutch lady in her blog and about the cleanliness and orderly this. And then before that, it was some like French woman or whatever, I forget her name. I think she has the same agent as me too, but, and my mom just follows these. She gets obsessed by,
there was a very Andrew Maine statement.
A very
that
weird
aside
drop.
Of like, also, I think we have the same agent. Keep going though.
Yeah, it's fine.
Hey, what can I say? You know,
he's doing big star stuff, man. Don't even slow down.
I remember anyhow. I digress. But
so do you think that your mom would be into marry a condo?
Oh my God, yes. Oh yeah. And again, like I'm laughing not because like, oh, Netflix is so dumb, but it was when Bryce said it. I'm like, of course, the two are meant for each other. I knew this was going to happen. You know, this had Bryce written all over it. You know. Oh yeah, and I love that we live in a world where you can do a show like this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's.
And
you know,
and not just like a show of this content, but with like this the author and this personality who is, you know, not an English speaker, doesn't speak a lot of English. You have to lean on subtitling and captioning and translations. And, you know, if this was like an A&E or a TLC type show, you'd find an American to kind of repackage
to be blessed by Maria Kondo and do her version of it,
right?
No, and I'll tell you what, it's blown up. I mean, it was like dominated my timeline over the weekend. People seem to really love that show.
A lot of memes.
And it's a neat, again, as absurd and silly as I think it is, let me put it very clear, I love that we live in a world now where, like, as you pointed out, she gets to host that show. That also, you know, we've all worked in reality TV and on the broadcast, the cable side, and seen this stupid sort of, well, we need to have stakes. Okay, that's great. But the stakes they play, they want to put are often the dumbest ones in the world. I love the fact they get to kind of play this more like, hey, we're going to kind of like normal people and stuff and this, and let's do this. Not like, we're going to help Jeffrey Dahmer's mom organize her closet
yeah.
and scrapbook and go through those memories.
Yeah.
Hold a second. I think I've got a pitch.
Hey, man, as long as we're pitching, I'm afraid I'm going to steal both Justin and Andrew's pick. But I just heard a comedy album that I thought was really, really funny. It's not out yet, but it'll be out in 1 week and 1 day from today on 1/22. It's going to be a little thing called All's Well, a Night Attack album. That does. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Andrew, but there's a comedy podcast called Night Attack where two people just sort of run their mouths off and say a bunch of stupid stuff. And in and of itself, you know, it's mildly humorous. But
Canadian,
man, oh
right?
man, if you take these out of context quotes and wild jags that they go on, and you have a talented musician auto tune them and make musical masterpieces out of everything, my goodness, is it an utterly enjoyable. Very, very brief, very intense, very funny 50-minute ride. It might be, the of all the Night Attack albums, the one I'm proudest of, which is weird because I'm only recommending this as somebody who listened to it. I don't know why I would be proud of it.
Listen to it. Yeah, man. All's Well. Next Tuesday, it will be available. We are in the process of finalizing everything, maybe submitting to everything by tomorrow or so, hopefully. No.
And we don't have it up for pre-order for the live listeners or probably anybody who listens to this in the next couple of days. But after the fact, we have information on all the albums. I guess we need to update this page with this one too, at nightattack.tv/album. That's where you can kind of see, you know, the old ones, and then we'll have the new one up here when it gets here. But
give them all a little listen here. Yeah. But there we go. All's Well. One real quick pick to stay on the Netflix train. I finished The Kominsky Method over
the
week.
Is it good? Please say it's good.
It is one of the weirdest shows I think I've seen in a while, because it is a Chuck Lorre joint. He of, you know, the modern day sitcom kingpin of, you know, Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men and everything. So about 50% of the show is very Chuck Lorre. like very tidy kind of bits, very slice of lifey, sitcom-y sort of elements, like to the point where the old age jokes at times can be kind of groaners. And then it, without warning, will just steer you into these like dark, like fairly dark, if not out and out kind of cynical takes on life and aging and death. And it just swings between those unlikely pairings with reckless abandon. And, through the first two episodes, I was, you know, I was kind of like, all right, this is Chuck Lorre being able to, you know, say jokes that he wouldn't be able to say on CBS and show a boob here and again. But by the end of it, I was kind of in love with it. And that's on top of the fact that, you know, Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin are just great. It's great to see them, but man, the it doesn't necessarily go into like super screwed up territory, but it certainly lingers in some places that you would not expect. It almost feels like an independent movie or a 70s kind of movie that's more meditative about these emotions.
The abstract ideas of this actually kind of remind me of what they tried to do with The Ranch on Netflix, which was the Ashton Kutcher multi-camera sitcom about a guy going back home to his country home.
Oh, that's right.
But it was like kind of dark and not quite a comedy.
For a second, I was thinking you were talking about that. What was the Hulu thing that was a cult with Aaron Paul in it?
Oh, The Path.
The Path. Yeah,
that's The Path.
Right,
that's
is not The Ranch. No. Got it.
And I didn't like The Ranch because it felt like they were just trying to put these two ideas together, a multicam sitcom and something very serious, and you kind of run up against the... you run against the limitations of both of those things, but this looks like a single camera sitcom or dramedy.
Yeah, basically. No, it's single camera, and I will say I don't know if it would be able to pull it off if it didn't have the acting talent behind it. But when Alan Arkin, you know, breaks down and cries, you pay attention because he's Alan Arkin. Like that's just. What it is, and I don't know if it was somebody less than Alan Arkin that you'd be able to say, you know, oh, okay, well, this is as impactful. And also, I think it also subverts a little bit of the idea that a Netflix series tends to have season arcs, and things that are introduced tend to pay off. It is very much, you know, the 13-hour movie model. And this is unapologetically a sitcom. Like it has characters that, you know, that they grow on some level. They have moments, but like sitcom characters, like The Big Bang Theory, nobody really changes all that much because you got to show up the next week and be there. And it feels subversive in that Netflix universe where, you know, by the end of it, there are certain things that, without going into spoilers, you would expect would kind of resolve on certain levels. And yet these same characters keep making these same mistakes. And you're like, oh, wow, this feels true to the character in a way that sitcoms oftentimes feel like resetting everybody constantly feels like a contrivance.
Yeah.
I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. And I disagree with a lot of what you said, sir.
Okay. What do you disagree with?
Well, I mean, I don't think I've ever watched an episode all the way through of like two. I don't think I've ever seen more than 3 minutes of 2.5 Men. I don't think I've ever watched a whole episode of Big Bang Theory. So like, I don't know the fingerprints of Chuck Lorre like you do. You know, I don't know that. I watched this with my girlfriend. We binged it, and to me, there are very clear arcs, very, very, very clear arcs from, you know, the you know, the series, where they start, where they end up, how they changed. I could describe how they changed. The humor, I mean, and it's Michael Douglas, Alan Arkin, Nancy Travis. I've got more enjoyment out of this than I would say, like, Barry. I've watched the first couple episodes of The Marvelous Miss Maisel, which I get why people like it, but I thought this was one of the better comedies I've seen in recent times. I enjoyed this more than season two of Future Man, and I love Future Man.
So let me clear something up. I'm couching all this and saying that I very, very, very much love this show. And yes, there are arcs to the show. But without getting into too much, there are things that I think I expected as a viewer, understanding Netflix kind of shows, that I expected to kind of be in different places, and they weren't. And I felt that the show was richer for it. So I am not saying that it was in any way a bad thing. I very much,
not anything to take bad. Like, even like, I like the swings weren't as apparent to me, and I'm not saying they're not there. To me, I just like, I'm like, oh man, this is like a great, it was like, you know, you go back and you watch, and you made a good analogy to older movies, like, you know, Grumpy Old Men, and you watch some of those older movies where you watch really great actors later on in life doing stuff who are super talented in doing comedy, and I'm like, this was like that. But you watch, you're like, man, I'd like to see more. I'm like, yeah, this is like a thing, like a show about how to clean your closet that really would have a hard part existing elsewhere. This couldn't be on regular broadcast TV because it would be way more sitcom-y. So the writing for me was way above like some of what I've seen in some of those other shows. But yeah, I get what you're saying about like, man, we just loved it. We were delighted by it. The acting is just, you know, it's great. You know, Michael Douglas' character. I mean, there's like, you know, talking about it with my parents was fun, you know.
Andrew, you got a pick?
I am a fan of people who kind of just, you know, not necessarily just throw their hat over the wall. They set their hat on fire, throw it over the wall, and start a brush fire. And one of those people is Panos Cosmatos, whose names I can't quite pronounce, but he did a movie going now 9 years ago, Beyond the Black Rainbow, which I think was actually a pick that I had on this show, which was his sort of homage to like kind of a 1980s horror sort of film that filmed like something that was like David Lynch and, you know, Michael Mann got together and did a bunch of blow and decided to make a horror movie. He has a new movie that came out last year starring Nicolas Cage called Mandy, which is a very trippy horror romance, maybe, film you could kind of call, you know, about a wronged man who tries to seek vengeance, and extremely visual, extremely interesting. Nicolas Cage going full tilt Nicolas Cage in the way you like. You know, when you read the taglines and you see demon biker henchman, you know, what's not to like?
Sure. So
Mandy is my pick.
Very cool. Yeah, I know I read a bunch about it when it came out last year and never got a chance to see it, but I bet it'll be on VODs pretty soon, if not already. It was on September, I guess, so.
Yeah, so again, not for everybody. Definitely not for everybody. I don't want to go into plot points, but it's, you know, it's dark. It's dark and gory and horrific. So, gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.